Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulaby. This week on Culturetopia, the lost history of Marlon Brando's life as a musical innovator. The actor was also a drummer and an inventor. It's the year of the sequels. Hollywood's releasing a record number this year, 28 in total. All those part twos, threes, and fours might be good for the industry's bottom line, but it's making our movie critics' job a little tricky. And a look back on the life of Ernest Hemingway. But first,
the pop star Rihanna has had three hit singles from her latest album, and this month she's going for a fourth. Man Down has Rihanna's name on it, but dozens of people and lots of money went into its making. Zoe Chase of NPR's Planet Money team wondered exactly how much it costs to put a song on the pop charts.
The words hit factory used to mean an actual building where radio-ready pop songs got written. These days, hit factories still exist, but they're temporary. They're called writing camps. A record label hires the best and the brightest music writers in the country and drops them into the nicest recording studios in town for about 2 weeks. Ray Daniels was invited to the writing camp for Rihanna's latest album, Loud.
It's like, you know, an all-star game. You get everybody in. We're going to have the best of the best, and we're going to make the best records.
Here's who shows up at a writing camp. Songwriters with no music and producers toting music tracks with no words. Daniels manages a songwriting team of two brothers called Rock City. They had to write words to music they'd never heard before.
They'll go into the booth and they'll hum the record. They'll just say a melody.
All that humming is expensive.
Let's say if you got 10 rooms working. Every day, them rooms are costing anywhere between $2,000 and $2,500 per day per room. You got 10 rooms going, that's $25,000 per day.
That's not including the hotel costs, the rental cars, and the nice dinners. At the end of the 2 weeks, Rihanna picks her favorites. I didn't mean to end this life, no, it wasn't right, I can't even... What you're hearing is the demo for the song Man Down. Rihanna liked it.
They literally wrote Man Down in about 12, 13 minutes.
Def Jam bought it, along with the 10 other tracks that made up the album. The cost of the writing camp breaks down to about $18,000 per song. Man Down was released as a single off Rihanna's album 2 months ago, and we'll use that song for our example. The songwriter and the producer each got a fee for their services, $15,000 to the writer, $20,000 to the person who did the music. That's about $53,000 spent on the record so far, before Rihanna even steps into the studio with her vocal producer. The vocal producer's job is to make sure Rihanna sings the song right.
I need you to belt this out. I need you to scream this.
Enter Rihanna's vocal producer, Makeba Riddick. She's coached Rihanna to sing many chart-topping singles, and she's expensive.
It can start anywhere between $10,000 to $15,000 to go in and do a song.
So the writing camp, plus the songwriter's fee, plus the producer's fee, plus the vocal producer's fee, plus the mixing engineer's fee, it all adds up to about $78,000 to get to the finished product, the song. $78,000 is pennies compared to what comes next. It's not a hit song until everybody hears it.
A rollout of one record might cost $1 million.
Rihanna's here. Hey, Rihanna!
The reason why it costs so much is because you need everybody to move at once. You want them to turn on the radio and hear Rihanna.
Rihanna's live in studio 92.3 now.
And turn on BET and see Rihanna.
Your reactions to Rihanna's latest video, Man Down. Rihanna!
When you look on Billboard, you look on the iTunes chart.
Oh my God, it's Loud is number one on iTunes right
what?
Now.
What?
I need to pay to make sure the record is on iTunes. When you log on the Apple Store, I want you to see Rihanna first. All of that costs. I need everything to click at once. That's what the money comes from.
Daniels breaks down the expenses of what's called the record rollout into thirds. A third for marketing, a third for moving the artist around to different cities and countries, and a third for radio.
Radio, you're talking about treating the radio guys nice.
Paul Porter is a former radio program director. He remembers he hadn't been on the job for 2 weeks as programmer for BET before getting an envelope in the mail.
$40,000 in it. It was $100 bills, but I remember it vividly. I miss it. No,
Two other program directors I spoke to say they've never received cash. Their playlists are determined through market research on what their listeners want to hear. Ray Daniels says these days the relationship between the labels and radio is not so overt. It's more like a nice date versus prostitution.
You want to get a girl when you want her to be yours, what you got to do? Take on restaurants that are expensive, buy her expensive gifts. You got to treat her nice. That don't mean you're paying for her. That means you're paying to show her that you're serious about her. I'm not going to call it payola, but I will say that.
It's ballpark, but approximately $1,078,000 later, Rihanna's Man Down gets added to radio playlists across the country, gets a banner on iTunes, and the video drops.
Oh, yeah, you forgot the video. We're not even talking about the fact that the video costed $100,000 to $150,000. This is money. Like, we're talking about money and for something that might not work.
Indeed. Man Down has not sold that well, and radio play has been minimal. But Def Jam makes up the shortfall by releasing other singles. And only then, after the label recoups, will Rihanna herself get paid. Zoe Chace, NPR News, New York.
And here's what's hot in Hollywood this summer. The sequel. The movie studios will release more part twos, threes, or fours than it ever has, 28 at last count. Our critic Bob Mondello says that may be good for the industry's bottom line, but it is making his job tricky.
Partly it's the math. X-Men First Class is X-Men 5, but has First in the title to let you know it comes before the others. Rise of the Planet of the Apes is the seventh film in that series, but it's a prequel too, so I've been thinking of it as Planet of the Apes Part Minus 1, as opposed to the final Harry Potter flick, which is Part 8 in a seven-part series. Because, what the hey, they can.
Let's finish this the way we started it.
Warner Brothers split the last Harry Potter novel into a pair of films, so this second Deathly Hallows is Harry Potter Part 7, Part 2. The Twilight series will also be doing that with its last book, and I suppose I shouldn't complain. They could just as easily have made it into a trilogy. No doubt that'll occur to someone soon enough, and we'll be able to look forward to Part 12 in a four-part series. Feels like we're already there sometimes.
Hoodwinked 2.
Happy Feet 2.
Cars 2. Scream 4. Big Mama. Like Father.
Thank heaven Super 8 and Apollo 18 aren't sequels. Stop me if you've heard this plotline before. Actually, don't bother. We've all heard it, and we'll no doubt hear it again, because in 2011 there will be 9 Part 2s, 5 Part 3s, 6 4s, 5 5s, 2 7s, and an 8. If I'm doing the math right, that means the average sequel this year is Part 3.7. No wonder everything feels so familiar.
It is time for the next phase of your journey.
All these installments remind me of when I was a kid and picked up a volume of the complete Sherlock Holmes. I loved the first story I read and the second, but after a while I started figuring out the rhythms and the setups, and before long I was muttering "Elementary, my dear Watson," a page before Holmes did. At which point these stories weren't as much fun. We're not there yet with the Robert Downey Jr. movies, obviously. He's got a Part 2 coming up. But we sure are with Shrek and Pirates and Chipmunks. Do we really need more of those? And forgive me, but we're up to film 5 in a series that's always called itself Final Destination?
Are you saying that we can't stop this?
Apparently not. At least not as long as studios can say they're bringing the characters back by popular demand. I'm not sure who was demanding Hoodwinked 2. Whoever it was, please stop. But when films make a couple of $100 million, it's perfectly understandable that producers say, ooh, let's do that again. Just good business sense. Second films are easier to get financing for, they're already cast, and they're pre-sold, so promoting them is simple. So much so that the second film in a series often outperforms the first at the box office. After that, the glow generally fades, but increasing interest overseas now ensures that even as a franchise ages, the numbers stay big enough to keep it profitable. And you can't really argue with the numbers. So far this year, the top 3 box office hits are all sequels. Hangover 2.
I can't believe this is happening again.
Pirates of the Caribbean 4.
Is that really necessary?
And Fast 5.
We'll do one last job, and then we disappear forever.
Fat chance they'll disappear forever. In the last couple of months, those three pictures have collectively made more than $2 billion. And don't imagine this is anything new. For a whole decade, there have been Roman numerals after the titles of about half of the top 10 hits annually. And in every year but one, when Avatar opened, the number one picture has been a sequel. What's more, the other half of each year's top 10 immediately turn into fodder for new franchises, hence Avatar 2 and Avatar 3, currently on the drawing boards. In short, Hollywood has figured out how to ensure not just that we get what we pay for, but that we pay for it again and again and again. I'm Bob Mondello.
The movie The Tree of Life from auteur director Terrence Malick and starring Brad Pitt is playing in just over 200 theaters at the moment, and some of them have reported a peculiar problem. Filmgoers are walking out and in some cases even demanding their money back because the movie's just too arthouse. One theater in Stamford, Connecticut has actually posted a sign at the ticket window. It tells patrons that The Tree of Life does not follow a traditional linear narrative approach to storytelling, and it reminds them that the theater has a no-refund policy once they've bought their tickets. A small but consistent number of patrons have been walking out of screenings at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline, Massachusetts, too. Jesse Hassinger is program manager for the Coolidge, and he joins me now. Welcome to the program, Jesse.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
That theater in Connecticut was saying that about 5 to 10% of the audience walked out on opening weekend. What's the walkout rate there at the Coolidge?
I would say it's approximately that. The numbers aren't spectacular on the film because it is a challenging film to begin with, but I would say that for every screening, there's at least between 1 and 5, depending.
And is there a certain point of the movie when that's sort of when people up and leave?
About 25 to 30 minutes in is when the film kind of goes into the celestial, very beautiful space photography. And that's usually the point that people walk out on.
Mm-hmm. This is some sequence. I haven't actually seen the movie yet. It's a sequence, though, I gather, that has to do with the origin of the universe, the end of time. Dinosaurs are involved. Is that right?
Indeed. Okay. Indeed. Yeah. It's 2001 in scope. It is epic and goes from microscopic to multi-universe in photography, and it's just gorgeous, but there's absolutely no narration and no narrative to it whatsoever.
Well, what are people saying as they leave your theater, if they leave early?
They're either angry or they're baffled.
Angry?
Yeah, they get a little angry that we represented the film inaccurately because it's 20 minutes, 30 minutes into the movie, and it's supposed to be about a family in the 1950s, and all you've seen of this family by that point in the film is approximately 5 minutes.
You know, I have to say, it wouldn't occur to me if I hated a movie to ask for my money back. I guess I would figure it's sort of incumbent on me to get a pretty good sense of what the movie's about before I pay my, whatever it is, $10. Are you having people ask for refunds?
You're probably in the majority. People either want to see the film, or if they get frustrated with the film, they just want to go home and not have to deal with it anymore. But there's a small percentage of people that actually do demand their money back.
And what do you say?
We, for a number of years, have been saying about 20 minutes into the movie, if you don't like the film, for whatever reason, you can come out and get a refund.
Now, the theater in Connecticut, the Avon, which has this sign up, sort of a disclaimer about the movie, they say that the film has proved very polarizing, and they're just trying to be transparent. They also say that a lot of their patrons think the movie's a masterpiece.
I am definitely in that camp. I think it's one of the most important and best films in the past 10 years.
I suppose there would be people who walk out at some point of this movie hating it who would say, look, I'm all for art house movies. I love art house movies, and this one just was terrible. I couldn't stand it.
Well, kind of a funny thing has been happening, at least among my age group. I'm 30. They kind of go the opposite direction. They're saying that the overall themes are being beaten over their head, and they really don't see what the whole hoopla is, and that because I love it, I'm just buying into the whole thing. So it's almost a rallying against it to say that everyone who loves it is stupid and it's too simple to be worthwhile.
Mm. Has there been a movie, Jesse, that you've walked out of early?
I pride myself that I don't walk out of films. I kind of have a motto that there's at least one redeeming feature in any film that is made.
Jesse Hassinger, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Jesse Hassinger is program manager of the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline, Massachusetts.
So, Samuel F. B. Morse was a painter and inventor. Here's a story about an actor and inventor. It begins in a nondescript storage facility in West Los Angeles, which contains a little-known bit of Hollywood history. It concerns the late, legendary Marlon Brando, but it's not about any of his stage or screen roles. NPR's Felix Contreras traveled to Los Angeles to find out more.
Behind this roll-up door sits a collection of items from the very public life of Marlon Brando, the actor. Among them is a marked-up script for the film Mutiny on the Bounty and a large box of letters of admiration from people like Frank Sinatra. There is also a peek into the life of Marlon Brando, the inventor.
Yeah, I see the cone, huh?
Can you see it?
There were three made. This looks like the second one.
The
one
from Michael Jackson, too. Yeah. Let's take a look and see a little bit, huh?
Grammy-winning Latin percussionist Poncho Sanchez, patent attorney Kevin Costanza, and Brando estate executor Avra Douglas, they're all here to dust off Marlon Brando's patented invention for tuning conga drums. Yes, you heard correctly. The Oscar-winning actor was also an amateur drummer and inventor with four patents to his credit. Attorney Costanza says Brando was a regular reader of Scientific American magazine and had a seemingly endless stream of ideas.
He had these shoes that you could wear in the pool that would increase the friction as you walk on the bottom of the pool, give you a better workout. And he was fascinated with the geodesic dome, always talking about ways to build things using the geodesic dome.
Through assistance, Brando contacted Costanza and hired him to work on the drum tuning design. But Costanza says Brando's people laid down some very strict rules before any conversations could begin.
He doesn't want to be called an actor. He doesn't want to know that he's your favorite actor. He doesn't want to know how much he loved his movies. He doesn't want to talk about acting or Oscars or any of those kind of things. He was an inventor, hiring a patent attorney to get him patents for his drum invention.
Brando spent more than 5 years working with Costanza on schematic drawings. Production designer Jack Connor made custom drum parts. Then in 2002, Brando was awarded the first of four patents for various parts of his design. Basically, Brando's system would replace the five or six bolts around the head of the conga used to tune it or change its pitch with a system of linkage connected to a single tuning lever.
Boy, Marlon had to sit around and think about this for a while. Let me tell you, man.
But Brando died in 2004, and efforts at licensing the design to conga drum manufacturers came to a halt. The design then became something of an urban legend among Latin percussionists.
I heard about the drum, but I'd never seen it before, so this is the first time I'm seeing it. Pretty far-out invention, man.
Poncho Sanchez met Brando in the late 1970s, and Brando called him 2 decades later to seek advice on the invention, and the two spoke on the phone frequently.
It was outrageous at first. My wife, I'd be out on the road, and my wife said, Marlon Brando called you today.
All three prototype drums made for the patent applications were thought to be lost until Kevin Costanza recently tracked this one down in this storage facility. He was anxious to see the design in action. Sanchez was eager to finally test it out.
If you want to hit it, I could crank on the crank and see if you can get it to change the pitch.
Brando's invention attempted to improve on a design that has been in place for well over 6 decades. Inside the storage room, Costanza turns the crank on the side of the drum connected to the linkage inside, while Sanchez tested the tone.
So you have to tighten it up. So this would have been a good idea where I could just reach down and tighten it, and then the pitch would go up. That's kind of a good idea, you know?
Soon, the drum was ready for a test drive. Ultimately, there were no takers for Marlon Brando's invention. A representative for a drum manufacturer that considered marketing the design told me he thought the idea was practical, but he was reluctant to tell the actor it was not very cost-effective, joking that he was afraid of an offer he couldn't refuse. When Costanza mentions Brando's frustrations at all of the production delays and his own failing health, the executor of his estate, Avra Douglas, suggests the great actor, or rather inventor, would have been more than pleased with today's events.
I know he was very excited about it. He had really high hopes. He was passionate about it, and he would have been thrilled to see Pancho playing it.
For now, the drum will go back into storage. Douglas says there are no plans to do anything with the design other than let it rest with the other mementos of a very full life. Felix Contreras, NPR News, Los Angeles.
50 years ago today, the writer who seemed to personify courage and strength put a shotgun in his mouth and pulled the trigger. Ernest Hemingway was 61 years old. He was a boxer, a boozer, a philanderer, a big game hunter who wrote some of the most sublime prose of the English language, short, sharp, piercing sentences that told stories about soldiers, lovers, and hunters, bravery, fear, and death. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1954 and once wrote, "He didn't regret that all the time he'd spent shooting lions, catching marlins, chasing Nazi submarines, drinking, carousing, and telling tall tales in bars, had taken him away from his work." Corey Stoll, who plays Ernest Hemingway in the film Midnight in Paris, reads his words.
"In going where you have to go, and doing what you have to do, and seeing what you have to see, you dull and blunt the instrument you write with. But I would rather have it bent and dull, and know I had to put it on the grindstone again, and hammer it into shape, and put a whetstone to it, and know that I had something to write about, than have it bright and shining and nothing to say, or smooth and well-oiled in the closet, but unused."
Many wondered, how could a man who would define courage as grace under pressure take his own life? Over the past 50 years, the reasons may seem less mysterious. Hemingway's father had shot himself in the head with a Civil War pistol, and suicides often follow a family line. Hemingway drank too much for too long and couldn't stop. He boxed, brawled, and otherwise battered his brain in car, motorbike, and airplane accidents. He suffered from headaches, sleeplessness, slurred speech, and depression. He began to hear voices and see things, and told his wife Mary in January 1961 that he could no longer write a single good sentence, and Ernest Hemingway would only settle for great ones. But today I'd like to remember the Hemingway who was 23 years old and indestructible, struggling in Paris to be a writer. He wrote a short story, not even 1,500 words, called Indian Camp, which a boy named Nick Adams accompanies his father, who's a doctor, to an Indian camp in the Michigan woods one night, where his father delivers a baby and discovers that the baby's father has slit his throat. It's the first time Nick has seen a baby born or a man die. And in a boat on the way back home across a lake, Nick asks,
"Why did he kill himself, Daddy?" "I don't know, Nick. He couldn't stand things, I guess." "Is dying hard, Daddy?" "No, I think it's pretty easy, Nick. It all depends." They were seated in the boat. The sun was coming up over the hills. Nick trailed his hand in the water. It felt warm in the sharp chill of the morning. In the early morning on the lake, sitting in the stern of the boat with his father rowing, he felt quite sure that he would never die.
The words of Ernest Hemingway, as read by Corey Stoll. Ernest Hemingway died by his own hand 50 years ago today.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/pickthatup and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.